Coming up, we're going to talk about the latest in the electric vehicle industry, that microcosm of the automobile industry that seems to be exploding before our eyes. And we're going to be talking about the fantasy garage. What are the four vehicles we would have if we could to fill our four-car garage?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 215 for October 18th, 2013. Four Car Fantasy.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Glad that you're with us for another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours. Joining me tonight is Mr. Jim Hall of 2953 Analytics. Jim.
Thank you, Peter.
The man who knew too much. And Mr. Todd Lasseff from Automobile. Todd, it's always a pleasure.
Peter, it's always good to be here.
Good to see you. And we're waiting on Scott Burgess, but he will come. He'll show up.
Sometimes he comes with tacos.
Yeah, sometimes he comes with food that I can no longer eat, but that's okay.
That'll go good with the coffee.
I'm going to take a brief second here to promote some upcoming Autoline After Hours shows. On October 24th, we have Mike Swears, who's head of the Toyota Tundra. October 31st, we have Mitch Claw, who's in charge of the Jeep Cherokee.
The highly controversial Jeep Cherokee.
Yes. And on November 7, we have Taj Schuchter, head of the Corvette Stingray.
We always have trouble pronouncing his name. I'm still not sure
Taj Schuchter? Yeah, Taj Schuchter. Yeah. And he's head of the Corvette Stingray, which is, you know, obviously one of the most envied positions in the entire industry.
I've always thought that the chief engineer for the Corvette and the chief engineer for the 3 Series are the two dream jobs for a lot of automotive engineers at other car companies.
I would add chief engineer to the 911.
I understand that, but boy, that's when we aren't going to be able. There's stuff you're not going to be able to do.
Maybe the most coveted, but also one of certainly the toughest, probably.
911. Yeah. Oh yeah.
I think. I mean, you're dealing with historical implications, historical expectations,
and now you're dealing with the Porsche Boxster and the Cayman.
Which, we'll get to that later. Yeah. But if I were going to order a high performance Porsche right this second, I would get a Cayman S. But we'll talk about that later. So it's not old. It's kind of old news, but it's still kind of on the front burner. Cadillac released the price of the new ELR. Fairly dramatic.
$495 more than my prediction.
Yes, the price is
$17,995.
$75,995 or $68,495 minus the federal tax credit. Now, it's amazing to me how many people comment about the ELR not being, you know, Cadillac is forced into this damned if they do, damned if they don't proposition with this car. If they charge too much for it, they're going to get slammed. If they don't charge enough, it'll be beneath the Cadillac image. But one thing I'd like to point out to a lot of the people out there who haven't had the opportunity to see the ELR in person, I mean, folks, it's a dramatic car. And it's when you see it, you might think, or if you know the business, oh, it's got some Volt in it. But when you see the car on the road, the impression is totally different.
I have a friend that worked on the program, both as a concept and production, and the interesting comment was they wanted it to be a car that you'd buy regardless of what kind of powertrain it had. And they nailed that. They actually did. I mean, the car stands on its own from a design standpoint. It's striking. We've had a neighbor that had a Tesla car, development car. He's driving around a black one, and it was like, whoa.
The one difference between the time they showed the car as a concept, which was, 2009, I think, or 10?
2010, I think.
2010, yeah. And now is that now you have the Tesla Model S on the market, and psychographically, at least, those cars are aiming for the same buyer. Probably won't get the same buyer.
It would
be tough. I'd take the Cadillac over the Tesla, probably.
I'll disagree about the psychographics. The fact that the Tesla is a large, usable four-door sedan skews it. It really does. It gets a buyer in that the ELR won't.
And that's true.
But that's a psychographic reason for buying. The other thing is the Tesla, and I like the Tesla a lot, but the Tesla is not a, oh, my God, styling car when you see it. It's a very attractive, handsome car. There's nothing about it that screams, by the way, I'm an electric, which is true also for the ELR. But the point is the Tesla is a modern, very fast roof, four-door/five-door, like an A7 or even a Jag XF.
True, but anybody who recognizes it as a Tesla knows that it's an electric car. And in fact, we've had people comment on, one of my colleagues was talking, I can't remember, this is a while ago, ran into someone who asked what he was driving. He was driving an Aston Martin Rapide, and the average person on the street thought it might have been a Tesla. So it's funny that you're getting cars like that mixed up with Teslas, but not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I think about the pricing, very interesting pricing on the Cadillac, which is about $5,000 or $6,000 more than I had expected. I thought it would come in at just under $70,000, is that if you look at what Cadillac did with CTS pricing this year, it's also being very aggressive there. On the one hand, it needs to be. On the other hand, the worry is that what are the ATPs going to be? Are they going to be heavily discounted from those prices getting up into the low 60s?
Yeah.
And still, they're still about $5,000 less than a comparable BMW 5 Series or a Mercedes E-Class.
But if ever there was a Cadillac that is an example of you don't want to sell one too many, and you want to have a big gap, it is the ELR.
Oh, no question.
Because
sure.
The ELR for Cadillac, especially in markets like California, it's going to change the perception of Cadillac. And it's expensive, and it's exclusive and hard to get. The whole point of it, I'm convinced they want this thing to be a car that you've got to wait a little bit for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's the right way to do it.
Well, I mean,
on the other hand, the other problem, though, is that because of all the criticism of the Chevrolet Volt, you're going to have the same thing happen. The people who just don't like what's happened to General Motors in the last 4 or 5 years.
There's nothing you can do for those people. You can't run your business for those people.
No, but there will be a lot of noise. There will be a lot of noise, and especially in the mainstream press, about is this car selling or not.
This car will be invisible in the mainstream press. At launch, it will. It will be invisible.
Well, this...
Mainstream press really pays attention to all so-called green cars.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be entirely invisible.
In the touchy-feely enclaves in this country, California being number one, I think the ELR has a shot.
I do, too.
I really do, because I'll go back to what I said at the beginning. People have no idea the presence this car has.
And Cadillac is a brand that is still amorphous in California. It's not... What is it? I'm not sure. You know, and the new stuff has helped, but in California, you know, the Cadillac is as much an Escalade image as anything else still.
Sure. I mean, because all the stars are driven up to the previous in them.
And by the way, the new Escalade.
It's pretty sweet.
Uh-huh.
Pretty bold.
It is, because they de-blinged it, sort of.
Yeah. Well,
someone's pointed out, I think Jalopnik pointed out that that whole market for the Escalade is, that's... Very 2008.
Yeah, it's a different market. You know, they know that. But the thing is, when I had heard, oh, they're going to, you know, the Escalade's going to be built off Lambda, they're going to get rid of the truck-based vehicle, and you knew it never was. Because, does a truck-based Escalade hurt the Cadillac image? Not if it's done right.
Yeah.
And I think the new interior on the Escalade is stunning.
Actually, all the new Cadillac interiors are pretty darn good. Now, there's some very funky stuff going on in the CTS. There's that sport interior with the mismatched red console and door inserts. And it's like...
Yeah, but I just saw that the other day in person.
I have two, and I still don't like it.
I didn't mind it. I think the XTS is really nice inside. The XTS.
Well, the XTS Platinum is one of those interiors where, other than when you... This bothers me because I see it. The stuff they had to do the power shade in the back took a rework of the door trim, and it doesn't match. But,
right.
But the thing is, other than that, when you're in that car, it's one of those things where every little detail has been thought out. You know, down to the purple stitching, but used very discreetly.
And yet I can't get beyond the fact that it's, basically a tarted-up Buick LaCrosse, which is a tarted-up Chevrolet Impala.
Well, yeah.
I mean, no. It's I'll accept it being a tarted-up LaCrosse, but the Impala then is a tarted down XTS because that's the cadence that it shows in each of the cars. Each one of those vehicles is better than the one before it.
Well, we know that on the street, there's another car with tremendous presence.
The Impala?
Well, the Impala and the XTS, except from the back, it's a little light. But coming at you on the road, the XTS is nice.
All the XTSs, though, to me, look like they've been used in a front barrier test. The front, the fronts are a little too short for me.
You see that kind of flies in the face of your commentary on Autoline Daily.
What are you saying?
Several weeks ago regarding dash to axle.
No.
I mean, I think it has a lot to do with that.
The thing is, you could fix what I consider the problem on the XTS by pulling the base of the windshield rearward. It's a perception of how long the hood is.
You know, we cover a lot of ground here, folks, so just bear with us.
We've been all over the map on this one.
So, but, you know, besides the touchy-feely enclaves or the Teslas, you know, people are hugging them on the streets or whatever, the single highest word-of-mouth thing I'm hearing on the street is the Chevy Impala. People come up to me all the time, oh, you're, you know, whatever, and it's, you know what, really?
Tell me about that Impala.
Yeah, I mean, I hear it all the time.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got great presence on the street.
No question.
The Impala is one of those cars. Yet at the same time, to me, it's a design disaster in the rear because when you see them in traffic, if it didn't have the gold bow tie there, there's nothing about it that says I'm a Chevy. And Chevrolet's been pretty good in kind of reinforcing the
should have done more with the tail.
Absolutely. And look at the
face. You think they should have stuck with round?
I'm not saying that, but look at what they've done just with the facelift on the Malibu.
I'm not saying they shouldn't have.
Look at the facelift on the Malibu, where they took the forms that were sort of doughy and they made them a little more distinctive to say Chevys are these separate taillights.
I just wish they would have done some really wild LED, like almost bullet lights, you know. Just not retro, but just
avant-garde.
Futurist.
They could have done carrots like the 59, which actually probably the Ford Fusion has more of in the back.
Yeah.
But anyway, if I had been pricing the ELR, I would have priced it at $67,500, get the tax credit, $60,000.
And I would still be doing it at 75. I seriously would. Because I would rather sell 1500 too few.
Yeah, move that to the center.
Sorry.
So
I would rather sell 1500 too few.
But
seriously.
It'll be very interesting.
No argument.
Because I think when the people in California see it on the street, they're going to go, whoa, what is that?
It cuts a swath.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it does it without being a big car. That's what's doubly interesting about it.
Well, that's the other thing. I was trying to convince the people who are really writing about it and poo-pooing it. So you don't understand the package, what it looks like in the flesh. I mean, it's pretty cool.
They had a challenge with that car because it is mechanically a Volt. There were things they could have done to decouple it from the Volt, but it would have delayed the car, use the new family four-cylinder engine in it, which apparently was in the plan for a while, and then they'd have a different battery pack and so on. So that was all doable, but it delays the car. So they've done some stuff. To make it refined inside, it has extremely aggressive active noise cancellation.
Oh.
In an electric car. So it has the potential to be very spooky quiet inside, which I say great. Because that's another thing. When you get in it, it'll make the experience different. Because this is about a car that it looks good and you drive and you think, I did the right thing.
Let me ask a question. Since you mentioned California, Ford has been touting its huge rise in sales in California, bigger market share. What do you make of that? Is there much to that? Are they just renting out more cars there or what?
They have cars in rental. Everybody does.
I think they're actually actually moving the needle.
You know, one of the first cars or vehicles out there that got California awareness was the Flex.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a product that arguably is of questionable value in some parts of this country. But to me, it's exactly what Ford needed. They needed a car that when it's out there, you'd look at it and go, whoa.
Mm-hmm. That's the highest word-of-mouth product Ford has, the Flex.
The Flex.
I mean, people who have them absolutely...
They love them.
And overall, they can't give them away. I mean, the compared
on a national basis, but therein lies one of the issues with being popular in California. If you do it with a car that's a product outlier, it's a challenge then to bring the rest of your range into the sort of the vortex that's being created by that car.
Right.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another subject. BMW has been surprised by the advanced orders for its i3 in Europe. And Jim and I were talking earlier that the interest in the i8 is skyrocketing.
Hand raisers for the i8 globally and especially in Europe, it's amazing. There are people that are saying, yeah, I think that's what I want.
And I pointed out on the table on Auto Extremist site that Tesla's, you know, they've dined out on a lot of, you know, laudatory prey. I mean, the press is just like, you know, let's genuflect in front of Tesla. Let's, you know, it's got this buzz.
Wall Street certainly has genuflected.
Well, the stock thing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm not into giving stock tips, but really, people, I mean, that stock price is just ridiculous. But the thing about it is Elon and company better, you know, tighten their belts a little bit, because it's going to be the first time that they really get a dose of the power of branding. And when you have the BMW and they're there all of a sudden, I think it's going to change the dynamic quite a bit.
And maybe, and I know you don't want to talk about the stock price, but maybe that's just giving them so much hubris because, pardon me if I mentioned this last time I was on, when Tesla had its Q2 phone call, the analyst call and reporter call a couple of months ago, our David Zenly was on the i8 launch where they gave him a little drive in it, a little ride in, I think. And he called in to say, you know, the BMW guys mentioned that they're really impressed with Tesla. Meanwhile, the very same day, I mean, the very same hour, perhaps, I was listening in on the call and an analyst asked Elon Musk what he thought of BMW's efforts, and they laughed about it.
Yeah.
They laughed about it.
Does
he know it's coming?
Mm. No, they know it's coming, but they got to understand that, one, remember, that the Tesla Model S, when it was originally planned, was, and it's been engineered to take a range extender in it. That's never been offered.
Mm-hmm.
And their attitude, and they may be right, is that for their part of the market that they're in, those customers don't need a range extender. They may be absolutely right. The i8 is not available without an 8 range extender. So it is, to them, a different kind of car.
Right.
Okay, and I can understand them poo-pooing it for that, because saying it isn't really what we are. The i3, on the other hand, defaults without a range extender and has a range extender optional. It's going to be interesting to see what the take rate is in the United States for the range extender model.
Well, what's interesting to me about the i3, and I mentioned this on the show way back, is without the range extender, this is a 2,700-pound car.
Right.
Which, I think this is an opportunity for BMW. I mean, it could be the most fun, you know, relatively affordable electric car out there. I mean, it might redefine what BMW ride and handling and feel, you know.
Right, because it's still rear-wheel drive.
Yeah, so that's going to be a very interesting car. I mean, obviously, it's homely.
Protonic blue with turbine-style 625 wheels. This is my i8.
Oh, man.
And by the way, so now we're talking about two cars that basically bookend the Tesla Model S. You have the Cadillac ELR on the lower end.
Yep.
And really, the Tesla Model S, if you want the longer range version, is a $100,000 car.
Right. No, it's $136,000.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of being attacked from both sides, it'll be interesting.
But my point on
again,
this
again, this is a different body style, I know.
Yeah. And the thing is, no, you know, I'm going to give Tesla credit. They are running a pure electric here.
Yeah.
That, for a lot of buyers, is way more car than they need from a performance and from a range standpoint, which means it's a viable automobile at a price.
I understand that.
And so far, nobody has come to take them on that level.
But a lot of people just, you know, they think electric and just tune out. They
right, don't, absolutely.
You know, range extender, pure electric, you know, they just think electric. And my point was that Elon and company is going to really get a dose of the power of brands. And
I think it's going to be interesting if the third generation car, if they realize they're going to need a range extender for it to do volume.
Well, you know, but let's talk about, again, the car in this price range, $100,000 electric car. We're not talking about buyers who are looking at either or. We're probably talking about people who can buy a pure electric car because
they have other cars in the fleet.
BMWs and Cadillacs and whatever. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's going to be interesting. I'll go back to design has been and will continue to be the ultimate initial product differentiator.
Yeah, no question.
And see, that's where the Tesla in my mind, is very attractive, but it falls short.
Yeah.
It is not a car that when it goes by, you look at it and go, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very pretty, very attractive car.
Yeah, I mean, but nothing really stands out about it.
Yeah, and everyone, you know, the i3, you know, it's not the most attractive thing, but I can't wait to drive
it. Maybe the least attractive thing, frankly, but it's fine, you know?
I can't wait to drive it, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Want to know if it drives that weight package. It's got to feel like the 2002
Peter, it's 2,700 pounds low in the car.
Yeah, I mean, it could be really hot. And then the i8, I think, is just a stunning car.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't like the concepts they showed at the auto shows, but boy, when they showed the real one, I was just like, oh, man.
Understand something, that the i8 versus the Tesla in the marketplace, not as competitive vehicles, are going to show not just the value of brand, they're going to show the value of marketing and broad-based retailing.
Right, right.
That's something that right now Tesla has chosen, in one respect, not to do, and it may be a brilliant move for them. That may be exactly where they basically can own that concept. But on a global basis, the economies of scale that BMW could realize are something that Tesla has to, at one time, they're going to have to address that. They're going to have to answer it.
Yeah.
And it may be in 5 years, it may be in 10, but they're going to have to address it.
So it's going to be very interesting. I think Cadillac, again, going back, I think they have a real shot at the LR.
I hope so.
My contention is that they need to follow it up.
Yeah.
The ELR as a standalone, you know, they're working on the second generation Volt right now.
Right.
And I rather suspect from a design standpoint, that's got to be very, very difficult. Because, you know, how much do you change it? How much do you keep the same? How much do you fix? Because it has some real hiccups on it. But the point is, Cadillac has to basically say, we need another product other than a second generation ELR. They need another. And whether it's a range extended or a pure electric, they need another product out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they need it. The sad part is they need it by 2016, 2017. And they won't have it.
Yeah. So, Todd, what have you been driving lately that you can talk about that is an embargo?
That I can talk about? well, that limits it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I had a little more of a drive in the new Corvette, which still impresses me quite a bit.
Now, did you drive the Z51 car?
Yeah. And I mean, it's just so much better than the previous Corvette. The handling, the feel.
The interior.
I drove here in one of the fastest cars you can drive in the Detroit area, Toyota Corolla.
Oh, yes, stealthy.
Nice and stealthy.
Absolutely invisible.
And boy, I'm impressed with how unimpressive it is. How it's all surface, the new sheet metal, the new interior.
But it's one of the most powerful
brands.
Brand / nameplate.
Yeah, just the fact that, just the inertia in being able to sell those cars. Yeah. Let's see, what else have
we? And for most people, it's more contemporary looking, so it'll, you know.
Yeah.
I do like the CTS, both the twin turbo does wonders for the V6. The naturally aspirated V6 is still a decent car, but boy, they need to improve
engine, that engine
MVH
needs,
at idle on that car.
They have to improve the MVH at idle, and they also have to make it so when it makes noise, it's making sound rather than noise. Because when you go wide open throttle on it, it's not unpleasant, but it is not the kind of music you could get out of a bunch of other cars. Yeah, exactly.
It's not what it should be for a Cadillac CTS.
Well, or for a car in that segment.
I also don't pay as much, certainly not as much attention to commercials and marketing as you do, but a couple of car commercials recently have struck me for good and bad reasons. One is Ford, and I think this shows how bad the commercial is. I think it's for the Focus, if I remember correctly.
And
the sweet and sour
chicken.
They're trying to do a Geico, and it falls flat, and it's awful.
The problem is they did one of those commercials, and they followed it with I think they're three now, where they say that's the power of and, which is better than or.
Yeah,
and the
exactly.
problem is it was one of those things that was good the first time, use it and bury it. See, Geico, that
was
one
good,
thing,
but it was not great. It was no Geico commercial.
No, but Geico doesn't use the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, and that's
exactly
what Ford's doing.
But I mean, the pacing, the way the commercial appears,
the cutaway to the Chinese restaurant,
it looks like it's supposed to be a Geico commercial. The very good one, and this shows this is the reason why this car company is doing so well, I think, is Subaru. And the latest Subaru commercial has father teaching his twin sons how to drive a stick shift, and it's just a very nicely done commercial. It's not specific to the car, although they show a new Legacy, and he's taking them for a drive in the old Legacy. But, my God, showing kids how to drive a stick shift. When do you get that in car commercials
anymore?
Yeah,
that's radical.
I would probably find that insulting because, you know, I was a twin that learned how to drive a stick shift. But for me, it was in a Austin Healey, which is a hell of a lot better than a...
Yeah, well, how many Austin Healey commercials have you seen lately?
Not enough.
Exactly.
Why, Mr. Burgess is here.
Mr. Burgess is here.
This is a mess. I apologize.
Yeah.
Yep. It should not take an hour to drive from Royal Oak to...
No, that's why if you're smart, you take you do 10 mile.
I'll do something different next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Scott Burgess from Motor Trend.
No tacos.
How are you?
I was late. Normally I'm early and I bring the
tacos. Yeah. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well.
Well, we're at the point in the show where we're talking about recent drives, that cars you've driven that you can talk about that aren't embargoed, that you have anything to comment on.
I'm driving a Toyota Sequoia right now.
Wow. It's big, isn't it?
It's gargantuan, and it's not a very impressive interior.
No.
That's the one. I have a theory that Toyota is slowly removing things from the interior to see how much consumers are willing to accept.
Well, no one can get away with.
Yeah. We know that Honda did that with the last Civic.
Yeah, and they're now backpedaling in a big way.
Yeah.
One car I should mention, I hate to interrupt, but... I also drove had a more extended drive in the Jaguar F-Type. I liked it, didn't love it. And this is a V8.
Six is the more interesting vehicle.
And you can't find a six in America.
I know.
Yeah.
But it is the more interesting.
Probably better balanced, I would imagine.
The supercharged six is pretty sweet.
I was able to drive it back-to-back with a Cayman S. And
there's no comparison.
There's no comparison.
Well, you know, the thing about the Jag, I want them to do well with it. I mean, your initial reaction to the car is, ooh, yeah, it's cool. And then you get up to, you know, my impression is any number of car companies could have done that car. That's my impression of it. And that might be wrong, but...
There's nothing about it that says this could only have come from the house of William Lyons.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think, Scott?
I like it. I like
it's
the...
It's not that you don't... I like it,
it's
too.
It's not that I don't like it.
It accomplishes some things that Jaguar wants, which is... One, it's a sports car, and
They want to attract. They want to attract attention. We've got to get people getting in the showrooms. So.
Man, that car will bring people into showrooms just to look at it. It's everywhere you drive it. People look at you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really turns heads. And so those things I think are good. Now, overall, you know, handling and I mean, it's a nice, powerful engine. Sounds fantastic, and
it doesn't sound like a Jaguar though.
No, it sounds like a. It's like the Jaguar GT500. You know, and...
That's about right, yeah.
It's a little unwieldy, you know.
There's still a little bit of Ford in every Jaguar you drive, right?
And, you know, I mean, that back end, I remember we were trying to shoot photos and we wanted to do drifting photos. Jaguar F-Type photos were done in about 35 seconds. Go around one corner, whole thing, back end shoots out, you know, and...
Get your pictures.
Yeah, and you're done. So, I mean, that's really nice that way. Whereas the hardest car to get drifting photos is like the 911. So you got to try all these different tricks. It was with the all-wheel drive version.
Why does this surprise you?
No, I mean, it should. It's not, but it's just...
That's why there's a parking brake. Oh, it's electric in that car, so that doesn't work now.
Yeah. That's a shame.
See, there, Todd, is one of the new technologies that I do not embrace.
Believe me.
What is that?
The electric parking brake.
Oh.
And it's because too many times I like pulling into my driveway... basically, with a handbrake turned, the neighbors all cheer, and some of them have cards, 9483.
Yeah,
so, I, you know, and then the neighbors love me because of it. That's why
that is a lost art, I will say that.
And the Alpha 4C has a handbrake but no manual, and the Porsches
the manual,
have
but the
manuals but no handbrake.
If you're smart, you'd never buy a manual Porsche anyway.
I do.
Have any of you guys driven a 500L?
Yes.
Oh, you mean the Cinquecento L?
Yeah.
I guess since they didn't put it in the same showrooms with Duecentos and Tricentos, we can call it the 500.
Trecento.
But right. The reason I thought of it is it's handbrake, which is hidden underneath the armrest in case you want to try to reach it.
As if anybody's going to use it because everybody will buy the automatics anyway.
Well, no, but the handbrake for doing a turn, it's tall, it's good. It actually responds well to handbrake.
Oh,
turning.
It does. Okay.
It's actually, it's not as bad to drive as I originally thought.
Whoa.
It's still a it's more of an experiential vehicle than it is a one. And I, the interior makes no sense at all. The folding seats that roll forward that don't actually create more room. I don't know what they were thinking.
That's called reallocation of interior mass. We've made a mountain. Look, and now we have a valley.
On that note, Ben, let's take a break here, and we'll hear from our friends at Bridgestone Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Okay, we're back. Scott, did you want to add anything about the ELR pricing before we...
I was really surprised at how expensive it was.
Were you really?
Yeah. You know, when you originally thought about it, you go, you know, maybe it would have been a better idea to have the Cadillac ELR first before the Volt.
But you see, that's the bottom line. That whole technology should have been launched on a Cadillac where they could have warranted more price, lost less on the initial cars. But the decision was made by the then chairman of the corporation to make it a Chevy using the...
Back in the Rick Wagner days.
Yes, that's right. That using the idea, well, Toyota's hybrid came out as a Toyota instead of a Lexus. So, yeah. Well, it was... When your chairman of your car company is making product decisions for things like, you got a problem, and that's true for any car company on earth.
Yep. I stand. But, you know, that could have been $55,000 and then or $60,000 for the ELR.
My number was $60,000, after the tax credit.
And I was saying $75,500 all along.
But the other thing we talked about is people really don't realize the size of the package, its presence, and how really striking it is.
It's a beautiful car. It's you know, the couple times I've seen it, you're just like, wow, this is nice.
It is a candidate for exterior ambient lighting. That car is a genuine exterior ambient lighting is coming to cars. You're going to see it on the exterior of cars.
And it's all LED too, isn't it?
All the lighting's LED, yeah. And then because that's really the wise way to do it with an electric.
Exterior ambient lighting where? What do you mean exactly?
You're going to see it. You know, Mercedes has the optional three-pointed star that lights up, but you're going to see exterior ambient lighting come to cars. The regulation is very straightforward. We've had it on a car back in 1986. Mercury Sable. That had that grill that lit up. That was exterior ambient lighting. You could do something with the Cadillac grill, because the Cadillac grill on the ELR was a challenge. How do you give a car a grill that doesn't have a grill? And you could have had each of those squares glow from behind very dimly. But the thing is, and that's the thing. You're going to see stuff like that. Caddy should have done it on that car.
It's all Woody Allen sleeperish to me. Didn't those cars have the...
Well, no. Remember, their whole interior is lit up, and you couldn't see out of them.
Right. Those cars didn't need fabulous. To because they were... They were autonomous.
And, Jim, we talked about a vehicle that you can't talk about, so I'm going to talk about three vehicles I've driven in a row, the GTI, the CC, and now I'm driving the new or the current Audi A4. The GTI is one of my all-time favorite cars.
Never, even late in its life cycle now, it's a fabulous car to drive.
Never disappoints. And if someone said, you know, Mr. DiLorenzo, you are done. You have one car, and that car will have to do everything you need, but that's it. It will be the GTI right now, followed closely by the Fiesta ST.
Fiesta ST, I've driven it recently, and it is an absolute knockout.
Yeah.
It's a hoot. That car is...
I don't know why you would bother at all with a Focus ST, because I've driven them back-to-back on the same day, on the same roads.
Save $5,000.
Save $5,000. It doesn't torque steer in the goofy way that it does. It's a more predictable way. It's a lot more of a hoot to drive. There's more feedback to it, and the noise is better. It, you know, that thing makes great sound.
Now, that was a car that, when I was driving it, you really look at it and you go, I could drive this every day. I could drive it to work. I could drive it on the weekends. I could put all my crap in it. And there's no real downside on that car. It's just really, really well done.
And I drove the Volkswagen CC, which is like, why? I mean, it was, I don't know, whatever reason it existed before, it's pretty much done. I mean, the design seems stale now.
I think it took the facelift they did to sort of bring it into the new design language thing. I thought it took it pretty well. When you realize there's only one piece of tin they changed on the car, that's good work.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's just really, there's no compelling reason to get one.
Well, only if you want a European Passat, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd get the Passat instead, actually. And then I have the current A4 Quattro, just a standard 2 liter car. And, yeah, and I had an S4 for my personal driver, and I loved it. And so this is a weird car for me because it's like, wow, this is like an A4. I mean, I just had no experience in that car.
It's amazing how well they make that 2 liter Ford work with an 8-speed auto. It's a phenomenal job they've done with it.
Yeah.
In that it's not hunting for gears. It's responsive when it needs to be.
And I have to give Audi some props because actually the A4, I mean, it's got some driving character to it. Even, you know, it's not the S4, but at least they make an attempt.
Yep.
So.
I got out of a Cayenne Turbo S that was merely wonderful. But at $168,000, it damn well should have been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those big Porsches. The first time I ever noticed this was when I was driving a 928 for the first time. My brother was working at Motor Trend at the time. I'm going to Art Center. He says, you want to drive it? It's like, yeah. So I'm driving this 928 on the Ventura Freeway. And Bob is like, we're passing a lot of cars. And I think I'm doing like 60. And I looked down, it was 88.
I tell you what, that 928 S4 at the end, boy, that was something. That was a fast, confident.
But that whole aspect of just eating miles at high speed was in the Cayenne. And the other thing is, it is astonishingly refined from an NVH standpoint. That car is not noisy. It's not got a lot of wind noise. And it's punching a big hole in the sky. There's tire noise because the 21-inch super aggressive tires. But still, it was astonishingly refined. And it wasn't what I expected at all. I expected to be a little bit more...
What are those
chewing nails and neutronium?
What do those things weigh these days compared with other SUVs in that size category?
On the redo, it
lost some weight.
Lost 700 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a lightweight, but it's not the heaviest car in the segment, if that's what you mean.
No,
and it was 550 horsepower, which takes care of some of that mass.
I know.
Some of my wallet.
Mm-hmm.
Got about 9 miles per gallon.
Maybe.
No hypermiling for Jim.
Well, hypermiling in a car like that takes on an entirely different meaning.
Yes.
It's when you push the clutch in.
Yeah.
It's hypermiling.
So, Scott, what's on your mind this week in the car biz?
Nothing much. You know, it's been kind of a quiet week. The one really fun thing we got to do was go ride two laps in the Z28 the other day.
I was there too, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Is it not a different car?
Is it? You know, the thing I was really surprised about was the interior was actually very nicely done. And
did you expect it to be more gutted?
Well, for a race car, it is.
I thought, you know, like the Viper ACR where they charge extra money to take out stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and they did take out, like, the trunk lining and a couple of other things.
And some speakers.
But
they used the V6 Camaro's headlamps and tail lamps on it to save weight.
Yeah, and
versus the SS.
They left the backseat in because you would have had to replace it with metal structure to hold, and the seats actually serve a structural purpose as well. So they're like, well, we carved them out a little bit and made them a little bit lighter that way. But the thing that was most impressive was the braking on that car.
Yeah.
It was just...
And is not the throttle response astonishing?
We didn't drive. We only rode.
You were riding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we were... the professional drivers drove us in.
Okay.
You know, the MRC...
I'm in trouble.
Careful.
Now.
MRC. We all know the Lutz ring.
For the people out there who don't know, this is the special road course that GM constructed at the Milford Proving
Ground. Two test vehicle dynamics, too. So it's
right.
Every turn is off camber, and you know, and it does a really good job of scaring
right in the middle of the old truck loop.
Modeled something after the Nürburgring, but it's only 2.9 miles. And
that's shorter than the Nürburgring.
Much shorter, yes. Coming on to that, onto the second lap, the braking zone.
Yeah.
To illustrate what Scott's talking about. I mean, the driver went so deep into that and then just slammed the brakes and then turned.
They're hitting 150 plus, 150 plus, on that first straightaway going into turn one where you go downhill and then it's just really
tight. It's like the carousel is what it's like.
It is unreal what that, and what is it, 15-inch carbon ceramic discs on the front, or 15 and a half and 15-inch on the backs. I mean, they're just massive.
Yeah.
And one of the drivers was telling me that when they drive it all out, you know, when they're doing vehicle dynamic testing, they can do 22 laps before they run out of gas. And he goes, there's no brake fade. At the on the 22nd lap, there's no brake. And you're just like, that's unbelievable because it's
But it's not a car that's you can't use it as an everyday car.
They don't want you to. Yeah. It you know, this is such a limited edition car, and it's obvious that they're, I think we talked about this earlier, that they're using this to build out the LS, which
LS7.
Was an LS7 engine, and probably build out a lot of other things. Who knows? You know, the tires are Pirelli. What's the? I mean,
they're P0 isometricos. Aren't
you know, if you drive it to the track yourself, you better watch the tires after.
Yeah, you'll only get 10,000 miles on the tires.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just gravel sticks.
Well, my favorite all-time Camaro was the 68 Z28, and then the corresponding Mark Donohue Penske race car on the 68. Not the 69, the 68 was the small...
Pure Camaro.
And
I had a 67 Z28, and when I bought it, I didn't know it was a Z28.
Only you, Jim.
It was a cheap, beat-up Camaro, you know, but...
I was excited that GM... did the new Z20. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, isn't it, though, that Ford pulls the pin on the Boss 302, the model year when the Z28 comes out.
They said that they're beating the 302 on that track by 4 seconds.
Okay, first of all, remember that every car on Earth works really well on its own test track.
I know.
It's like General Motors has all these validation tests, and their cars pass them, and all the competitive vehicles don't. Turn it around and take that car to the Toyota. I'm sorry. But I want to see somebody get a Boss 302 Laguna Seca and a Z28 and put them on a track and go at it.
Well, this is the one thing I offered up a few years ago, and the manufacturers, you know, they didn't. But this country needs to have a test. We can't keep going. I mean, you can go to the Nürburgring. I love the Nordschleife. It's awesome.
Are you actually going to save the ring? Because you know it's in deep trouble.
Yeah, but why not have an accepted by all the manufacturers in this market test, like how fast you go around Road America? And I don't understand why we can't do that here. We should do that here. And there, that's your point. So... And you bring the cars to Road America.
Absolutely. I'd say Laguna Seca myself, but that's because I'm a California guy.
Yeah, I know, but Laguna Seca.
And I would go with Road America, too, but if Germany
You're
can't
from
hold...
Wisconsin, for God's
if
sake.
If Germany can't hold on to the Nürburgring, how are we going to do something like that here? It's just not going to work.
But it's an interesting...
It's going to be like the...
Track.
It's going to be like the government shutdown.
But what I proposed was to have a two-week period in the summer called Manufacturer Days. And you have different classes per day. You know, if you want to run in the B segment, okay, that's B segment day. And then you can just do the whole thing. And then you would have, it's a neutral site, mm-hmm. and you just bring your stuff, and, you know, then we'll see, you know. But
and you better have very close SAE inspection on that.
You think
what
those cars
would
be optimized? I don't, no.
It's like the GTO that Pontiac brought to the infamous test with the real Ferrari GTO, and... I mean...
that was 250 GTO versus 389 GTO.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that 389 GTO was
sure it was. Come on.
Who knows what there was, like a NASCAR motor in it. But, okay, before... We're running out of juice here. But before we do that, it's Fantasy Garage time. Our favorite recurring thing on Online After Hours. Imagine if you have a four-car garage to fill, and you can pick your climate. You know, if you're going to have four seasons, that's fine. I don't really care. And tell us what your four vehicles would be, and there's no required segments you have to fill. If you want to have four Ferrari 458 Italias in your garage, it doesn't matter. That's your garage. And, you know, what would you do? Now, just for discussion starters, now I'm the host, so I can change my list by the minute. For discussion starters, I have In one slot, I would have a Porsche Cayman S, six-speed manual, not PDK, a Ford Fiesta ST, or maybe the new GTI that's coming, a Rolls-Royce Ghost or Panamera Turbo, Turbo S, I haven't decided yet. And then the last slot would be, and that probably won't change, is a 1973 Porsche 911 Carrera RS. So, Scott, what would you have?
A 64 Lincoln Continental convertible.
Cool.
Because of the rigidity of the body.
Because you like to go swimming while you're driving?
Yes. I would say, I actually really like the Cayman, but I would take the PDK just because of traffic, and it's faster.
Faster.
And probably a, I'm trying to think, either a Ram or a, you know what I like is the Ram, the Laramie Longhorn 2500 diesel.
So you'd have a pickup in one of your slots.
That might take up two slots, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, you're not, done. Leave it, I thought. Don't have any more room.
And, the S-Class, the new S-Class, which I think is a phenomenal, that's what my driver would drive me around in.
Wow. How about you, Tom? What would you do?
My needs are modest, Peter. I would start with the Porsche Cayman S manual just because, yeah, I'm old-fashioned that way. I'd stick with our Miata with a manual because it's got a handbrake and a manual, so you've got both of those. Another very personal car, and this has a lot to do with my wife Donna and I. We need to have a Bug Eye Sprite. That's what I mean. My needs are modest, and then just because I'd love to have one of the early ones in as good and original condition as possible, I'd go for a Citroen DS21.
Cool. Ooh. Mr. Hall, the man who knew too much.
My daily driver would be a Brewster Green Rolls-Royce Phantom Coupe. Because it's the one car I could drive now until I can't drive anymore.
The Wraith?
No. A Phantom Coupe.
Okay.
Okay? Not as nervous and sporty. The car I would take, and this would be in Santa Barbara, by the way, and then for Cars and Coffee in on Olive Mill Road, it would be a Sang Bleu Bugatti Veyron. The half-polished, half-blue carbon fiber. And then my daily driver, the regular car would probably be an Audi A7 diesel.
Ooh, that's a nice.
And a
A7 diesel.
An A7 diesel, yep. Mm. It's a great combo. That package works. And then probably a Boss 302. A real Boss 302.
A real, and a 69.
Yeah. No, sorry, a Boss 429. A 69 Boss 429. Okay. Grabber blue, white interior. Hmm.
By the way, my location is Four Seasons. That's why I need the car with the handbrake.
Oh, what do you need?
For the winter.
Oh, you need the handbrake for dry, too. I don't. Winter. In the winter, I'd go in
winter's this. Just for fun.
Yeah.
My Four Seasons, Fiesta or the GTI, I could drive that every day. So, well, of course, you could drive the Panamera Turbo S and the Ghost, too.
Yeah.
You get winter tires, you could drive all of them every day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially the Panamera. The only thing you have to worry about is ground clearance.
Yeah. You only got to worry about clearance.
That's right.
Dave Leone, a few weeks ago, mentioned that when he said that he's getting as his personal car the Cadillac CTS V Sport, which is rear drive only, and he'll just put Blizzax on it.
That's a really.
I just
nice
need a lot. I might need one of those four spots just for the space for all the Blizzax.
Well, let me just say, I had an S4 with the automatic, and I had summer tires on it.
Oh,
and
you could always go.
Yeah.
Sometimes steering and stopping was
tough. I was warned, and I said, I'll give it a shot. Then, in the midst of that, Audi sent me an S4
with snows.
Manual with four snows, and it was just like, oh, yeah, I get it now.
My first.
That S4 with summer tires and was treacherous.
I had a B5 S4, the first V6 turbo they did in the States. And I took delivery of it in November, and I'm thinking, all-wheel drive, I'll be fine, and got one of those snows. Pulled out of the driveway, went down towards Riverside, T-junction at Riverside, and I'm thinking, well, the car accelerated, okay, it's fine, and it wouldn't stop. And then I basically went back to the house, called Tire Rack, and said, quickly, snow tires and wheels, please. And it's transformative on a car like that. Well,
I don't know why more dealers don't have something set up to where they'll store your tires. And
it's funny because the Mercedes dealer in Birmingham used to do that, but they got so much business they couldn't do it anymore. I mean, there was a time when owning a Mercedes was an exclusive thing.
I tried telling Cadillac that if they wanted to kind of move up into this, German luxury car echelon, they should do a program like that. They should make that part of their deal. To make its dealers stock.
Get a storage bin at one of these places for $100 a month.
And then
fill it up with somebody's tires. I mean,
and then include that as a package on your cars. Say, okay, you can have a CTS with rear and with all-wheel drive, or maybe a CTS and for
two more times a year they come to the dealership. More. That's two more times that they get an interface that it's a positive experience.
When it's done positively, it's good. Yeah, right. But when they find out that your wheels are still in the bin in the storage unit.
My wife reminds me that we need a doggy car, so I might replace the Citroen with...
Texted you with...
Yeah, she has.
Citroen, not Citroen. Citroen.
She would correct me on that, too, with either an old Vista Cruiser or a Buick Sportwagon.
Cool.
Oh, a Greenbrier camper.
Oh, God, no. That thing was awful.
They were selling one for $3,000 at that.
I saw it.
Were they for $3,000?
This was the orphan car show in Ypsilanti. It was spectacular this year.
Three of us were judges.
Hey, Ben, let's roll the rapid fire. Okay, Ben, let's run that call from New Jersey.
Hi, John, Ian from New Jersey. I had a quick question. In hindsight, what do you think? Would money have been better spent keeping Jaguar at Ford rather than spending the money on Lincoln? Personally, I think that has better traction in this type of buying market. Thanks again. Bye.
Well, hindsight's 20/20.
The issue with Jag is that Ford is going to need a luxury brand, and building it from scratch is way more expensive than retaining Volvo and transmuting it, which was one option, or retaining Jag. So in that respect, up from the start, I thought they needed one premium brand that they could use on a global basis, because Lincoln, they'll first got to get Lincoln reset for the U.S. market before they go overseas.
On the other hand, I submit that Tata is better for Jaguar than Ford was. I mean,
that's a whole other issue, though.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're talking about what would be better for Ford, that's a whole other.
Or maybe Volvo.
I don't think that Ford handled Jaguar that well to begin with.
No.
And by owning by having PAG, that's really hurt Lincoln in the long run. We're seeing that impact now.
Right.
And, man, I don't know what they're going to do with that brand. It's a lot of work down the road.
Ford's got this Vignale series in Europe launching.
Which looked pretty good, actually.
It looks pretty good. And, the only thing that's going to save Lincoln is China. Trying to pull a Buick with it.
The problem with Ford and the Vignale stuff is that in the top of the market, they're going to start getting more and more encroachment from Audi, Mercedes, and BMW. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I got my choice of buying a Mercedes or a Vignale Mondeo. To a lot of buyers, there ain't no choice there. I'm sorry. And in the bottom, their lunch is being served to them by basically Hyundai, Kia, Dacia, and Chevrolet.
Well, and then the question, too, though, in the U.S. market, when you talk about the upper brands kind of coming down and encroaching on...
Well, I was talking about in Europe, too.
Yeah.
It's going to be bigger in Europe.
But encroaching on, say, Ford Titanium, which is the top trim level here...
Sell the dealers, principals, and their wives and girlfriends.
Is that, it would do the same thing to Lincoln, or it will do the same thing to Lincoln.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Jonathan Brown 1 says, have they priced the Z28 yet?
No.
Yeah, they just say it will be north of the
ZL1.
The ZL1, which is what, $60,000 in convertible trim.
$65,995, including shipping.
I mean, I love the ZL1 that I have.
I do too. The ZL1 is a tough car to not like.
Yeah,
but the ZL1 is.
You know, they were telling me that the ZL1 originally was going to be the Z28,
yes.
And they changed their minds and said, this is not a Z28.
Yeah, it was Mr. Royce that I think said, this is not a Z28.
And supposedly they took the badges off the concept at the last minute.
Good call.
It was a good call.
By Mr. Royce. Scott, this is for you. Rum and Coke says, you get a shout out from Charlie LaDuff in his book Detroit, An American Autopsy. It's a pretty depressing read. What's your take on the book?
I helped him with the part about the LA Auto Show when Henderson was fired. I was at a Cadillac event, and they were showing off all these cars. And then the word comes in. I'm sitting next to Rob Stelling. He looks over at a guy, and he goes, hey, did you know that Fritz Henderson, do you have any comment? Fritz Henderson being released, the VLE for the Cadillac Coupe. And his response was like, oh, shit. And then they all go into this office, but it's a glass wall, and we can see it. And they're trying to tape paper up onto the wall as all these executives are listening to the conference call. And you can see them all going like this. And one of the PR guys was outside just cursing because he's like, nobody's going to write about these cars. And that show, that was when they had the Cruze, the Cadillac. They had all these really important cars.
Yeah, it was
the
big reveal for them.
And then Henderson was supposed to be the keynote speaker. And they put a piece of masking tape over it and said, Bob Lutz. And he gave the keynote address the next day.
You can always get Bob Lutz, right?
But the book is depressing.
Yeah.
But
there's a reason it's depressing.
Yeah. Dr. Botox says, when does the Tesla S become a one-trick pony? When does it become just another car? We kind of ventured into that earlier, but
it never becomes another car.
No.
But it is a one-trick pony.
It may be a one-trick pony, but when you talk about brand, if one thing that Musk is doing with that brand is he's casting it as being, you know, you'd say, well, okay, it's no BMW, it's not a Cadillac, but that's the way he wants it. That's what he's trying to do with the brand, make it that outlier. We're not going to use traditional dealerships. We're going to do everything differently.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, let's add autonomy. We'll do it in 2 years, and I'll advertise for the engineers on Twitter.
Yeah, we'll see what happens when BMW. Yeah,
of course. 90% autonomy.
It's, 90%.
It's the last 10% that actually makes it autonomous, though.
Yeah. He also asked, will Anchorman sell any Durangos or just movie tickets? I wrote about this on the site. You know, I applaud them for trying something different, as they do, but it will sell more movie tickets than it will sell Durangos.
Mm-hmm.
It's no question by mine. Scott in Cleveland says, are the renovations to Cobo completed? Will they be ready by the time the show in January?
Cobo, we only go there once a year. We don't know.
Cobo, like Disneyland, and
Pontchartrain is renovated, though.
Define renovated. My definition of renovation of the Pontchartrain is probably different than yours. But the truth is, Cobo will be, the renovation will be complete only when man's imagination is dead.
Here's one for you, Jim. Beauregard Jackson says, you mentioned the Volt has some problems. If you were in charge, what three things would you change for the next generation?
The Volt would be an oh my God, look at me car, I'm different. That would be critically important, so you wouldn't think of it as simply
goes back to design.
Exactly, absolutely. I think that the interesting thing about the Volt was I think they nailed the interior for when they wanted to bring it out, because it was a different interior. You got in it, the way they hid the shifter, the use of the light stuff, it was interesting. I'd do that, but I'd sort of use more technology than they did in it because they sort of pulled back late in the program. And the whole thing is I would want that to be the absolute most progressive, aggressive Chevrolet from a design and a sort of a thematic standpoint.
I agree. Goat Rope asks, what is your favorite stripper? No, not Dixie Normus from the Bada Bing, but your favorite no-option car. The most enjoyable drive right out of the box without the price-busting option packages.
Well, we never get to drive those because the press cars are always loaded up.
There's a good answer to that, though, that we've all talked about.
Fiesta
ST?
Yeah.
But
base car, and that's pretty damn good.
Fiesta is the base car, though. You'd say that.
No, the ST is a model.
Yeah.
It's a model. It's a different engine.
Okay.
It's not a package.
All right. I think that might be cheating on his question a bit, though. I don't think that's what he was after, I'm guessing.
Well, if that's like a base model Lamborghini.
Yeah, a base Gallardo. That would be
yeah.
No, but you know what else you could say is probably a Fit.
Honda Fit is a good
car. Yeah, a Honda Fit or even a Chevy Sonic wouldn't be bad. Either one of those, I'd say.
Chevy Sonic 5 with a manual can be a grinny car.
Yeah.
Alexander asks, what's the deal with Sergio postponing Alpha's return to the U.S. again? Now, this isn't a postpone. This is basically Sergio sold the Fiat dealers a bill of goods. He said, you guys are going to spend, I want brick and mortar, and you're going to spend at least $1 million and preferably two. For that, you will get all these lovely Fiats to sell, and you will get first crack, and we will sell 70,000 Alphas a year.
Well, but while he did that, he also added 3 or 4 months on to the U.S. launch date. I mean, I was told officially, semi-officially, a few months ago that it was still on before the end of this year, and now it's clearly going to be the
yeah. However, next year. It was also came out that Alphas will now be sold at Maserati dealers. Fiat dealers aren't happy.
No, they shouldn't be.
They shouldn't be. Okay, we'll go on. Elba asks, one thing that I truly love about the Jeep Wrangler is how it simply bleeds American. Over the past 70-plus years, it has not stepped far away from its original. With the harsher new demands for higher MPGs, will this alter future generations of such an iconic American vehicle?
You see a new CJ, next-gen original CJ. It's huge.
Yeah, it's massive.
It's gigantic. It really is.
And I predict, and I'm only predicting this, I predict that as it goes forward, we might see a little bit of that taken out. We might see it come down in size and weight a little bit, although certainly the four-door version is what's made it a big seller.
I mean, the volume on the four-door. Funny, it took them so long to do that, and they were the guys that realized when they had the infamous, the original Cherokee, and then they did the four-door Cherokee because they also had the Wagoneer, and the sales of the thing just exploded. They saw it. I always wondered why they didn't do a Wrangler four-door earlier.
Well, look at how well the Grand Cherokee is doing these days. I mean,
doing really well.
Yeah.
12,000-14,000 a month.
Yeah. What do you guys think about the new Cherokee and the delay because of the transmission? What do you think is, how's that going to be resolved?
Well, it'll be resolved. They'll have a vehicle that'll have a transmission that works pretty well from a standpoint of shift quality and drivability and so on, and they have to do this. They could not let this thing go out unless it's absolutely bulletproof. Because you can see what happens. When Ford launched the current Escape, there were all these little things that just kept showing up, and they can't do that with this vehicle. They've got to get it out there and not have anything saying, you know, geez, it's got this.
It's a shame because it's a really nice vehicle.
And yes.
I like the vehicle. I've seen it.
And it looks a lot better than people think it looks.
Oh, and the guys that whine about it are the guys that aren't going to buy a new Jeep anyway. And I just say, you know, it's the 21st century. It's the second decade. Get over it. It's time for modern Jeeps. And God bless them for doing it this way.
But if they keep delaying it, maybe they should launch it in Alpha dealerships.
Hey, wow. Ben, let's run that call from New Jersey.
Didn't we get a call from New
There's
Jersey?
Another one.
Hi,
New Jersey, hello.
Jonathan out in New Jersey. I was curious, Todd brought up both the new Corvette C7 and the Jaguar F-Type. I was curious if he could, or any of you gentlemen who have driven in both, give your description of how they differ. I thank you very much, and I know all the Corvette guys will be interested in hearing it.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That's a good question. I mean, one way they differ is that the Jaguar F-Type I drove was about $40,000 more than the Corvette Z51 I drove. The Corvette still feels like a Corvette. It still feels bigger, even if it's not that much bigger physically. And the Jaguar is it's probably more of a muscle car than you'd expect a Jaguar to be, but pretty willing to oversteer. Yes, Jim?
Well, historically, the Corvette has always been an amazing bit of performance for the money for a long, long time. That defined Corvette, because the start, it was just the opposite. And that whole position they've got is hard for anybody to co-op. You know, you can get a Cayman up to Corvette pricing like that, and the truth is the Corvette will eat it alive from a standpoint of acceleration and probably even braking. Don't know about the road course. Pick the course. On some courses, the Vette will walk away from it. On others, it may not.
Are you talking about a regular Cayman or a Cayman S?
Cayman S.
Okay.
So you start looking at it that way, and that's actually the Corvette's USP.
And the new Corvette, I guess I should also say, has for a Corvette, has great balance. It's just so much better balanced than Corvettes have been. And strangely enough, I wouldn't quite say the same for the Jaguar, at least with that the supercharged V8.
Well, the V8.
And I wish I had driven the V6, because I think that's going to be the more balanced, the way to get that car.
Yeah, the supercharged V8 in it, to me, is sort of like, yeah, we can do this, so we did. But it's eye-watering money when you're done with it. Well, you saw it was $40,000 more than a Corvette. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what does it compete with then? Is it a 911 competitor?
No. Yeah, you know, our cover story was George Cocker drove it against the 911, and what was the third car? Was it a... Anyway, and you would think it would be more of a Cayman Boxster mm-hmm. competitor.
So. Well, I think they sort of split the difference in it from a standpoint of base price performance. They're above where the Porsches are, the mid-engine Porsches, and they're below the 911, but you start stacking up with it, and then it starts crushing into the 911.
To me, the Corvette is more work to drive than the F-Type. But yeah. when you're
talking about how it oversteers all the time.
No, I think it's more the attitude. When you get into the Corvette, you want to do the work. You want to go fast. You want to do those things. When you get into the F-Type, you're in a really posh car that can go kind of fast. But the Corvette, you're so low.
Pushes you to drive faster anyway. Just normally. It's like, faster, I can do more.
And let's not forget, I mean, this is where, and, you know, Jim kids me for not embracing the new technologies, but the Corvette, the only ones I've driven so far have been manuals. The automatic is still a six-speed automatic, whereas the Jaguar is automatic only. And mm-hmm. and so, to me, the Corvette's more engaging from that point of view.
Yeah. Well, here we are. It's time to put the campfire out, boys and girls. But we've come to the end of the line here. I'd like to thank my guest, Scott Burgess from Motor Trend, Todd Lassa from Automobile, and Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics and Autoline Design Handbook.
Yes.
And, you know, you can see all my stuff at autoextremist.com, blah, blah, blah. Friend Autoline at Facebook/Autoline Network. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. I'm on Twitter, but it's Peter M. DiLorenzo. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we'll see you all next week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.